Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to find meaning in a life marked by hardship and injustice, and what happens when the tide finally turns? By the time Damian Eccles was 18, he had already endured crushing poverty, abuse and neglect, and deep social isolation at school. He found solace in heavy metal music and took to wearing a long black coat over his clothes, and due to crippling depression, was declared permanently disabled by the Social Security Administration. But local officials in his hometown of West Memphis, Arkansas, somehow grew convinced Eccles was truly a bad person, perhaps a Satan worshiper, and a danger to society. So when three young boys in the town turned up dead and mutilated, Eccles and two friends from high school were quickly made the primary suspects despite a lack of any clear motive and ultimately the presence of DNA evidence that suggested someone else had committed the crimes. But that information came to light only after Eccles and his companions had been convicted and spent 18 years in prison, Eccles on death row. Damian Eccles has been free for just over 13 months now and has just published a candid new memoir of his experiences called Life After Death. Damian, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You write that you are plagued by this worry that people for the rest of your life will see you only as part of this horrible story. It has to make it hard even now for you to just meet new people. Like, do you explain all of this? Do you not mention it? How do you handle that?
Well, it usually, with the life that we're living right now, usually the people that we come in contact with are already aware of it. I guess what I was talking about there is, you know, a lot of times it can start to feel like you're losing your identity. Mm-hmm. You know, when people see you, they don't even see you. They see the case, you know, in their minds. In the public mind, you become one and the same, and that's what I want to get away from. But at the same time, right now, it's sort of a necessary evil for us. You know, this case took almost 20 years of my life away from me, and the last thing I want to do is keep having to talk about it. But at the same time, we have to, because we don't have a sense of closure yet. You know, mm-hmm. We're out, but we're still not free. And until we're completely and absolutely exonerated, and the person who belongs in prison is in prison, and the officials who did this to us are held accountable, we have to keep pushing forward with this. There's just no sense of closure for us yet.
Let's explain that for people who are not familiar with the case. You took what's called an Alford plea.
Right.
Can you explain what that is and how it works?
Basically, it's a way that the state can get out of being held responsible or sued for what they've done. It's a very rare thing in the U.S., although since it happened in our case, in such a high-profile case, it's becoming more prominent. There's many more people started to use it now because it lets the state escape accountability. What happens is you accept a guilty plea but are still allowed to maintain your innocence. So you get to keep saying that you're innocent. You're saying, I did not do this crime. But at the same time, you are signing a paper so that you give up all rights to ever sue the state of Arkansas for what they've done. The people responsible can never be held accountable or have to right the wrong in any way whatsoever.
Talk about the morning that you found out these crimes had occurred. Did it occur to you in a million years, they're going to think I did this?
No, never. I found out about it just like everyone else. I get up one morning, and it's the top story on the news. It's all the local news was talking about nonstop. Mm-hmm. TV, radio, newspapers, everything was focused on this case. And I was only 18 years old at the time, so I didn't pay, you know, a great deal of attention to the news, but at the same time, you couldn't escape hearing about this because everyone was talking about it.
Yeah. And when you were arrested, it seems like the officials who dealt with you initially were already completely convinced of your guilt.
Yeah, it started off, I don't think the West Memphis Police Department even knew who I was until what happened was he was, I'm not even sure what his official title was. He was some sort of juvenile handler.
Mm-hmm.
He used to harass me nonstop, and he later went to prison for stealing from the police department, and his partner was eventually fired for molesting teenage boys. They would come through the neighborhood and pick up teenage boys, and this guy would say, either you perform sexual favors or you're going to jail.
Hmm.
Well, this guy had been harassing me for, you know, at least a year. And whenever these murders happened, he is the one who turned the attention of the real police department in my direction.
So you're 18 years old. I mean, you had only been in sort of minor kind of trouble with the law in the past. Were you thinking, clearly this is going to, someone's going to figure out that, that none of this is true?
Yeah, because, you know, the initial interactions, it was so outrageous. You know, I was really young and really naive, and my thoughts at the time were, if you haven't done anything, then it's literally impossible for them to prove you've done something you haven't done. So I thought that, you know, eventually they would find who actually did it and leave us alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I didn't have any real experience with anything like that.
So you had a tough time growing up for a variety of reasons. Your family was very poor. You talk about that really sort of getting in the way of your parents staying married to one another.
Right.
But you did have a sense, and this really struck me, you are critical of a lot of the decisions your parents and then your stepfather made, but you do feel as if they loved you in whatever way they were able to express that.
Oh, I do think to the best of their abilities, they probably did. You know, my family was incredibly flawed. My mother, I guess at the age of three, when I was 3 years old, decided she really couldn't handle raising me. You know, she was still really young. My mother had me when she was 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So she, for the most part, gave me to my grandmother. So my grandmother was like the mother figure to me. You know, in my world, my grandmother was my mother.
Yeah.
So whenever she died while I was sitting in jail waiting to go to trial, it was like my family had died.
Hmm. Talk about, you didn't finish high school in part because your family moved and then it was just expected that you would go find a job or do something else.
Hmm.
You say that you didn't do well in school because you didn't do the work, but you liked being there. What was it about school that you liked?
You know, I really don't know. I've thought about it over the years, and maybe I guess it was just the energy. The energy of being around other people, because I grew up in the middle of nowhere. You know, by the time we moved into a trailer park, we thought that was moving up in the world. You know, to us, that was a drastic improvement in our life situation. So we grew up out in the middle of nowhere with just fields as far as you could see. So when you're going to school, at least you're experiencing an interaction with other human energy, which was something we didn't get to experience at home. So I think I loved that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I never fit in. You know,
yeah.
even then, you know, I didn't belong at the school where I went to. It was like a really, you know, middle class school where, you know, a lot of the high school kids drove their own cars or their parents' cars to school and, you know, had the latest shoes or clothes. And I just did not fit in any way at all. So that made it kind of hellish in a way.
You write about this moment where your family's about to move and they're cleaning out every closet to make sure they've forgotten nothing, and you discover this old black coat in a closet, and you talk about that becoming a sort of security blanket for you. Can you describe the garment and why it meant so much to you?
You know, it's one of those weird things that it was just, you know how you can find something sometimes in life? It could be a big thing or it could be a small thing. It could be a person. It could be a place. But it's like whenever you come in contact with it, something just clicks.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is of me.
Yeah.
This is where I'm supposed to be. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. This is my world. This is something that holds significance in some sort of way in my universe. And for me, I guess that's what that coat was, that very first one. It was something that as soon as I saw it, something in me clicked into place, and I thought, this is a magical thing. I love this. And I put it on, and it really and truly was like a security blanket. You know, always, I always dress in black and still do to this day. And for me, it really is like a security blanket. It's a source of comfort. It made me feel a little safer in a very unsafe world. Mm. Even now, you know, I have another one of those even now, another black trench coat that's, you know, made of leather, and it holds even more, I guess, significance now just because I got it when we were in New Zealand and just all the memories attached to it. It's almost like, you know, I can't even describe it. It really is just a piece of home.
Mm-hmm. You use that word magical, and it comes up a lot in the book, and you spell it differently than the conventional spelling in the United States. You put a K on the end. Can you talk about how the word to you has maybe a greater significance?
Well, I think it holds two meanings for me. One, when you add the K, what it does is differentiates it from stage magic, you know, mm-hmm. pulling rabbits out of hats, things of that nature. So it has two meanings for me. One is the spiritual practice itself, which encompasses a lot of things like energy work, you know, for example, Qigong and Reiki, a lot of different forms of meditation. It's like a combination of esoteric Judaism, Gnostic Christianity, as well as a lot of Eastern practices, you know, like Indian chakra meditations, Buddhist mantras, all of these different things. It combines them all. It's like an amalgamation of the East and the West. And technically, the term we use here in the West to describe it, to use this particular spiritual tradition, is Hermetic esotericism. But whenever you're talking about it in a conversation with someone, you know, that can be a tongue twister to try to get out all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So the word magic just became like a slang for that. And that's a lot of what saved my life in prison was that spiritual practice. You know, for example, there's almost no medical care in there. They're not going to spend a lot of time and money taking care of someone they plan on killing.
Mm-hmm.
So when I would get really sick and I was in extreme pain, that was the only means I had of dealing with those things. But I also use it in a way to mean giving life meaning. You know, not to live a mundane, mediocre, monotonous existence, but to do something that makes your life purposeful, that turns your life into a walking, breathing work of art.
Did you realize from the outset when you started keeping journals that those were a form of art?
I did. The way I felt whenever I first sat down and started writing them was that, in a way, for me, it was a kind of catharsis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it allowed me to express things. It allowed me to get some things out. And I've always loved writing ever since I was about 12 years old. You know, it's one of those things that just sort of scratches an itch deep inside you somewhere that nothing else reaches. But at the same time, from the first day I sat down and started writing, I always had this feeling somewhere in the back of my mind that I'm not writing entirely for myself, that maybe in the future there will come a day when this is going to mean something to someone other than me. So, you know, it was sort of half and half. Half was for me, half was for someone else that I couldn't even identify yet.
Damien Eccles is my guest. He spent 18 years on death row for a crime he did not commit. We're talking this hour about his new memoir, Life After Death. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Damian Eccles about his new memoir, Life After Death. He spent 18 years on death row for a crime he did not commit. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Damian, I want to talk about this because people who followed your case may be aware that one of the allegations made against you, or one of the things said about you, I should say, is that you suffered from really horrific forms of mental illness, that you were delusional, that you had sort of homicidal ideation. What you describe in the book is, some struggles with depression that can be explained by what you dealt with as a child. Can you characterize for us the extent to which you feel like you have suffered from mental illness?
Well, most of that was a horrible thing that was done to us. To me in the very beginning, when my wife and I were still really naive, we really hadn't learned how to handle the legal process yet. We mm-hmm. still hadn't figured out how to maneuver in it. One of the other guys who was arrested with me, his attorneys, came to us and they said, we have this woman that's going to do a mental health evaluation, and we think it's going to be really helpful to you, and we think it's going to, bring some sort of favorable action about in court and all this sort of stuff. And we were still naive. We didn't know what we were doing at this point. So we said, okay. So this woman comes into the prison, talks to me. She wrote the report up, but actually got some other doctor to sign it for her. We later found out that she couldn't be part of it herself because she had already perjured herself in court before, so she couldn't actually testify in court. So it was her report, but she got another doctor to sign it for. This report, it diagnosed me with pretty much every mental illness you can imagine, anything from, schizophrenic hallucinations to homicidal tendency, anything you can imagine was in here. And what it was for was we realized that one of the other guy's attorneys had this plan where he thought he could get his client free by putting this entire case off on me. Hmm. So he was going to make me look as insane as he possibly could. Well, by the time we figured out what was going on, it was too late. And still to this day, that is the number one thing that's brought up and used against me. And it's something that wasn't even done by the state. It was done by the defense. It was an incredibly hurtful thing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Email address is think@kera.org. I want to talk about the kinds of letters that you received throughout the time that you were behind bars. I mean, obviously, some of them came from people who supported you, who ultimately worked on your case. But they seem to have come in different categories because there were also people who wrote to you. Well, let's talk about those who were convinced of your guilt. What did you hear from them?
Not much at all. Mm-hmm. If someone really doesn't like you or someone thinks you're guilty, they're really not going to sit down and take the time to write you a letter.
Yeah.
It's different out here in the world where, someone could just send you a message on Facebook or something of that vein, social media. But I was in a situation where someone would have to sit down with a pen and a piece of paper and write out some hate-filled, venomous letter, which most people just aren't going to do. Mm-hmm. If you see someone on the street that you recognize from, say, a television show or something, you may walk up and tell them you're a fan. But if you see somebody from a TV show that you recognize and you don't particularly care for the show, you're not usually going to go out of your way just to go up to the person and say, I really don't like that show you're on.
Right.
And it's sort of that same way with the legal case. So I really didn't hear from too many people like that at all. And usually if you did, someone that would go through that much effort, you could usually tell there was something that wasn't quite right going on there.
But then there were also those people that you felt like had sort of a salacious interest in the whole thing, not so much in you as a person or in the case itself in terms of how it related to the mistakes that were made, but they were just sort of, interested in the murders. Is that the right word?
I think things like that would fall under two categories. I used to refer to them as rubberneckers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when you're driving down the highway and you see a car wreck somewhere and people will slow down and do everything they can to try to gawk at, you know, the scene and see what's happened and what's going on. You do come across people like that every now and then that, you know, you can tell that when they're asking, you know, a question about the case, it's not like they're asking because they care. It's because it's out of some sense of morbid curiosity, I guess.
Yeah.
Then you would also have other people, you know, as the years progressed, we became really close friends with people, you know, like Johnny Depp. He mm-hmm. became like a brother to me over the years. And people hear about that, you know, they're drawn to it for that sort of celebrity air that started to surround things as time went on, that, you know, they really don't care, say, about the case. They just want to see what's going on over here, you know, almost like some sort of Hollywood gossip show or something.
I thought it was touching that you noticed that from the very first letter she sent you, the woman who is now your wife was unique. She was the only person who had ever apologized off the top for intruding on your privacy.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those things from the very first letter that I ever... We've been together for 17 years now, and the very first letter that I ever received from her, I knew this was someone completely and absolutely unlike anyone that I had ever come in contact with in my life before. And it was just so different and so amazing and magical that I instantly felt this need for more, you know, mm-hmm. this insatiable desire of, I want more. I want to know what you think. I want to know what you feel about every single thing under the sun. And it was like I just couldn't get enough and I couldn't get close enough. But at the same time, it was also incredibly painful because, you know, I had been in prison for 2, maybe 3 years whenever we met. And I think part of me had already started to die inside. You know, it's like starvation in a way, mm-hmm. starvation of anything emotional, starvation of human contact. And when that happens, you start to wither and fade inside. And whenever she came into my life, whenever she found me, it caused those parts to have to come alive again, to start to have to feel again. And it was excruciating, almost like having to go through some sort of physical rehabilitation mm-hmm. for, you know, a severely damaged limb. So even though I just loved her so much I could never even begin to articulate it and could not get enough, there was part of me, I guess, that still cursed her for just putting me through this. You know, it was excruciating enough to have to go through everything I was having to go through externally. And then you add that, you know, that extreme internal factor, and it was just... You know, we don't even have words in the human language. You know, you say something like overwhelming, but that doesn't even come close to articulating it.
Did she have to convince you that it wasn't asking too much to decide to be married? You know what I'm saying? Because you married long before you had any hope of being released.
Well, I think we always had hope. I don't think either of us ever thought that I would be executed there, but it wasn't something we allowed ourselves to look at. You know, whenever they train race car drivers, they tell them, don't look at the wall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at the other cars on the track, look at your instrument panel, look at the track itself, but don't look at the wall, because you're going to move in the direction that you focus your attention on.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we never allowed ourselves to focus on something like me never getting out or me being executed. We always focused on our world, on our life together. And in a way, it wasn't even like we were waiting on some future time whenever we would be together.
Yeah.
For us, it was, we are together now. This is our world. This is our life. Every day, we laugh together. It's just, in a way, it strengthens relationships just because you don't have the traditional things that people have to rely on. You know, you don't get to go see movies together. You don't get to have dinner together. You don't get to sleep in the same bed at night. So you're forced to start exploring new avenues, to start, reaching in different directions to forge new connections. You know, it's almost like someone who has suffered brain damage in a particular area of the brain, mm-hmm. and then the brain starts to compensate by forming all these new dendrites to form connections, you know, to compensate for the part of the brain that's damaged. And that really is what it was like with our relationship. We had to explore new avenues, go into new directions, and in the end, what it's done is strengthen us a hundredfold, because now we have all of that that we've went through together, all of that to rely on, and now we have everything else that everyone else has too.
Can you talk about the relationships you formed with the other men that you met on death row? And I know you were socially isolated for long periods of time, but
right.
You write about these men, including those that you know were in fact guilty of their crimes,
right.
But you write about them with a compassion that I think might surprise people.
Well, you know, I think I don't have any more compassion on the act of murder and crime itself than anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, I still think it's despicable. I think the difference was most people may see these guys on the news for 5 seconds and form an opinion from that, whereas I had to live with these guys for years on end and saw not just the news stories, but the human aspects of them. You know, the average IQ of the person on death row is only 85. There were people there with much lower IQs than that. And, you know, they say that it's illegal to execute the mentally insane or the mentally retarded, that they cannot be put to death, but it's still done on a regular basis. And I would see it happen all the time. There were between 25 and 30 executions that took place in the time that I was there. And I saw them execute people who were not even remotely in touch with reality at all. You know, I would see the things they would go through while they were on death row. I saw things that'll haunt me for the rest of my life. I think the most famous incident in Arkansas was a man who had killed his in-laws, and then he decided to kill himself. So he shot himself in the head, but he survived. What it did is effectively lobotomized himself.
Hmm.
It was to the point where whenever they got ready to execute him, they asked him what he wanted for his last meal. He said he wanted pecan pie. He ate half of it, and when they came to get him to execute him, he wrapped the other half up and said he was going to save that one until after the execution.
Hmm.
You know, that's what's happening there, and most people don't know that. You know, most people, just judging from TV, they would assume that, you know, death row is full of these genius criminal Hannibal Lecter type people. And it's not the case.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Brad in Sherman. Hi, Brad.
Hello, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for Mr. Eccles. How long did it take you to get over, if you even have, the obvious anger this episode in your life must have created?
Oh, that was that was actually a huge thing when I first went to prison in the first 2 or 3 years. It got to the point where I would wake up in the morning furious. You know, from the moment my eyes opened, I was just furious. You're constantly thinking, these people have no right to do this to me. I'm not supposed to be here. So it's like you're going through all this indignity and this pain and this suffering. You know, it could be anything from having to eat garbage to being beaten by a prison guard. Whatever it is, you're suffering that, but you've also got the mental and emotional side of it, of thinking, I'm not supposed to be here in the first place. And it got to the point where it was eating me alive. And that's when I knew I had to do something. I had to find some way to cope with it. Which is what turned me to magic. It's what turned me to meditation. Eventually, I actually received Jukai ordination in the Rinzai Zen tradition of Japanese Buddhism, which is the same tradition that used to train the samurai in ancient Japan. And the reason I turned to that is because, you know, when you're going through all of that in the outside world, you're not hurting anyone but yourself by holding on to that. You know, there was a quote by the Buddha where he said, holding on to that sort of anger, that sort of frustration, that sort of rage is like drinking poison and hoping that it'll kill the other person.
Hmm.
And you have to do something about it, which is what led me to, you know, dedicating myself to meditation.
Do you feel anger about the deaths of the boys? And I know that you have, it's, evidence has shown that you're not responsible, but I wonder how you, whether you're able to give a lot of emotion to that horrific crime, or because you don't feel connected to it. I mean, can you talk about that?
It's one of those things that, you know, it's so bizarre to have something like that connected with your life. And it's almost too big to even get your mind around, mm-hmm. in a way. And it's one of those things that over the years, I thought about it a lot. And, you know, it's one of those things that I don't know if it's a hope or a belief. Maybe it's a little bit of both. That somehow or another, things don't just happen randomly. You know, I would like to think that those horrible deaths wasn't just some random, meaningless thing. That maybe in some way, somehow, it means something, and I guess that's the only way you can really deal and cope with things that are that horrific. But it really is too big to almost even get a handhold on.
We should say, am I correct about this? At least two of the parents of those victims have come out in support of you.
Yes, two out of three of the families have, and one of the families. One of the victims' mothers, his sister, his aunt, they were with us in Sundance, where we premiered the documentary about our case. It's called West of Memphis. But that family actually even gave me a pocket watch that engraved on it. It says, "Time begins now," and it had the date that I was released from prison. So they've been, you know, really supportive through this whole time that we've been out.
Are you, do you feel like you can find any meaning in your incarceration, that you become this voice for justice? Or, I mean, is there just no way to say this lost time was somehow worth it to the universe?
Well, I guess the easiest way to answer that's a really big question, but I guess for me the easiest way to answer it is just to say that there have been definite blessings that have come out of this situation along with the curses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't have met my wife otherwise. I wouldn't have, you know, all of these really dear friends and supporters that have become like family over time. I wouldn't have any of that if not for going through that hardship.
We're speaking this hour with author Damien Eccles, who spent 18 years on death row for a crime he did not commit. His new memoir is called Life After Death. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Damien Eccles. We're speaking about his new memoir, Life After Death. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Damien, I guess the flip side of the question I asked you before the break is, have you given a lot of thought to who you would be, where you would be, what you would be today, if none of that had ever happened, and if you had sort of stayed out of prison and just lived your life?
You know, I really have no way of knowing that at all. You know, there's just no way to know it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess going through this whole thing has led me to believe in some sort of pattern to the universe, you know, that it's not just all random chaos, but that there's, you know, maybe some sort of meaning that lies behind daily life. So I would like to think that maybe I wouldn't have just grown old and died there in a trailer park somewhere. But really, what it all comes down to is there's no way to know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Susan on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thank you, Chris. Damien, I grew up about 15 miles from the trailer park you refer to in a little town called Earl, Arkansas. I had a lot of exposure growing up to the kind of, neighborhood you grew up in, the kind of people you were around. My question is, how did you, having grown up in that trailer park where obviously there were not very many highly educated people probably, how did you in prison develop your intellect? Because, you know, growing up, it's not like you were exposed to, just tremendously intelligent people. I mean, I know that there, I don't mean to denigrate where we're from, but, I mean, the demographic is what it is. So my question is, how did you sort of transcend where you came from and, especially in prison where you were probably lucky to get a book a week?
Really, I think what it all comes down to is hunger. You have to be hungry. You have to want to educate yourself. You have to want to learn more. I think it's a process that you have to enjoy. And I think, in the world that you were just talking about, in the world that I came from, most people don't have that. I literally have a ninth grade education. I dropped out of school when I was in ninth grade, and that is more education than anyone else in my family has. It goes hand in hand with poverty, but for me, I always wanted to escape that world. And the way I would do that is through reading. I loved books. As far back as I can remember, I have always loved books. So even during the most brutal, hard, just the most horrific times in my life, I've always turned to books for relief, for sanctuary, for refuge, even for friendship. There are certain books I've read so many times that the characters in them feel like lifelong friends to me. And I guess I just fell in love with reading. Even when I dropped out of school, I would spend my days at the public library reading books. And that continued even when I was in prison. I read nonstop, and I would pick out a subject and try to exhaust that subject just so that I would have the frame of reference to understand what people were talking about. Whether it was reading the entire works of Freud or exhausting the American Civil War, whatever it was, I would pick a subject and devote a lengthy period of time to it until I had chewed through at least, the basics of it. As I was there longer and longer, my eyesight started to get worse and worse. I didn't see sunlight for almost 10 years, and my eyesight started to deteriorate rapidly, so I had to start being a lot more choosy on what I would read. So over the years, it gradually narrowed until all I read anymore were books on metaphysics, books on meditation, books on energy work, ways to enhance and improve my Reiki and Qigong techniques that were keeping me alive.
Can you talk about the people who would come to see you and the other death row inmates, not the ones who came to see you specifically because they had an interest in your case, but who just came as part of their sort of their spiritual mission or as something that they felt was important to do?
We had some really beautiful people that would spend their time. These people were, just saints to come into this environment because the prison doesn't want them there. They don't want outsiders coming in and seeing the brutality of this world that they're, for the most part, responsible for. So they would put these people through hell to even get into the prison, yet they would stick with it year after year after year. We had this one woman who was a lama in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and basically what she came to the prison for was to help men prepare for death, to prepare to be executed. So she would come and do these teachings and transmit this technique that was called Poa in the Tibetan tradition. And the essence of it is you practice and practice and practice until at the moment of your death, you eject a huge burst of energy out through the top of your head to help you with dying, basically, to enable you to die a good death. That was her job. And they didn't even want her coming in there, but she stuck with it year after year and put up with, you know, horrible abuse just to come into the prison and help us. Or my Zen master, who came all the way from Japan to Arkansas to see me, and he couldn't speak any English. I couldn't speak any Japanese, so we would have to have a translator. We would have these people who would dedicate decades of their lives to coming into the prison and sharing their spiritual traditions and their practices with us.
And it seems like just having people willing to look you in the eye was a big deal.
Oh, yeah, because those are the only people that treated you as human. You know, the guards and the prison administration and everything else, to them, you're nothing but a number. You know, to them, I was not Damian Eccles. To them, I was SK-931. I was the 931st person sentenced to be executed by the state of Arkansas. I was not a human being to them. You know, that's part of the whole reason why they force everyone to get the exact same haircut, wear the exact same clothes. They take away your name and give you a number. You are not human to the system. And when those people would come in and treat you as human and talk to you as human, it kept you from dying inside.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Marie in Dallas. Hi, Marie.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for having Mr. Eccles on this program today. And I just wanted to tell him how deeply sorry that I am that he's gone through that experience. I guess it hit home for me, maybe more so than other people. Being a mom of a teenage boy, he's now 13, and I cannot help thinking how it could have been my son, who could have been prejudiced against by society, just because of the way he dresses, the way he speaks, what he looks like, and he could have been like that. The second reason also is I am a medical provider. I work in a jail, and you don't know how many times I see young boys, young men, you know, 17, 25, or whatever, and then you wonder, and you look at those people. They're decent. They're good people. You wonder, why? What happened? Did they really commit those things? Did they really do the things that they accused of? Hearing Mr. Eccles on this program really, as a provider, makes me want to go back and really take a second look at those people. Not that I wasn't already doing that, but really to look at them more as human beings as opposed to just jail inmates. Do you understand? So, and also, Mr. Eccles, I wanted to say thank you for having your book on available for iBook. Because I already downloaded it as I was listening to the program. I downloaded it on my iPad. It was very easy, stress-free, and thank you for your experience.
Maria, thank you so much for your call. Do you want to respond to anything?
I just want to say thank you. You know, it means a great deal even hearing things like that from people, because when I was in, I had no faith at all in the system. You know, I saw how corrupt it was to the core. And I had no faith and no belief that it would ever do the right thing. But what I did have faith in was people, the people that I was hearing from, the people just like her who would say these things, and that it would keep me from giving up hope. It would keep me moving forward. I had faith that the system would not be able to get away with what they were trying to do as long as you had people like that who cared and were watching and listening.
You have a son yourself who was conceived before you went to prison.
Right.
It has to have been painful as a father to be away for so long, for his entire childhood.
Yeah, he's 19 years old now, and I missed every single part of his childhood. You know, he lived on the complete other side of the country. We tried to keep him as separated from the case as possible. So he lived far away from me. So most of the time I would only get to see him, you know, once a year at Christmas. So I missed out on every single one of his birthdays. I missed every single Christmas. I never got to do the things, you know, like be the tooth fairy or be Santa Claus. I never got to take him trick-or-treating. Basically, he's a grown man now. Mm-hmm. You know, he's, for the most part, an adult. I missed his entire childhood, and it's like we don't even know each other. We're trying to forge some sort of relationship now, trying to move forward in some sort of way, but he's past the age now where he needs a father, and this is all completely and absolutely new to me, so it's like we really don't even know where to start. We're just having to find our way along step by step.
You feel like having other children is something you might think about at some point?
I don't think so. I think I'm still relatively young, but I'm too old to be having to start a life completely from scratch the way I am right now. You know, my life is a huge, huge struggle right now. My wife and I, for the most part, were homeless for the past month up until a few days ago when we finally got a place to stay. You know, we were staying with friends who had a place to put us up or staying in hotel rooms where we could. And, you know, something like that, that's just not the, when we left Arkansas the day I got out, we left like refugees. I didn't have a penny in my pocket. I did not even have a spare change of clothes to change into. And that's just not the sort of life, you know, starting out like that. I'm almost 40 years old. You know, that's not the sort of thing you want to, you know, the sort of world you want to have a child in.
I know that when you were incarcerated, you were able to watch TV on occasion and things like that. But I wonder, what can you describe what it feels like to be free, to be out in the world, and to realize everything is in a way unfamiliar because you've only seen it depicted in a little box on a screen?
It's really, to be honest, it's terrorizing in a lot of ways. You know, dealing with the most mundane thing that most people take for granted can cause tremendous anxiety. Things like going to the bank and having to figure out how to use an ATM card. Or the worst for me is navigation, trying to find my way from point A to point B. Because for 20 years, I didn't go anywhere. I was in a box. And then all of a sudden, one day, they just said, okay, get out. Go out into the world. You don't know where anything is. You have to. It causes so much anxiety just trying to find your way from place to place that it just sort of overwhelms everything else. It's gotten easier over the past year. The first two or three months that I was out, I was in a state of shock and trauma so extreme that I was almost having to be led around like a blind man.
Mm-hmm.
As time has gone on, I've started to come out of it more and more. You know, as time has progressed, I'm more and more myself by the day. But it's still really hard. You know, I'm by no means close to making up for 20 years of education.
Are you happy?
I think I am, yeah. There are times when I'm beyond happy. You know, there are times whenever I have these tremendous bursts of excitement just because of what's possible now, what I can do now, what I can set myself to. I can move forward. All of my energy is no longer dedicated to trying to keep the state of Arkansas from murdering me. I can now take all of that energy that was put into merely surviving in prison into actually moving forward, into building something with my life. And when I think of those things and the possibilities that are out there, I feel not only happiness, but just huge bursts of excitement.
The new memoir by Damien Eccles is called Life After Death. Damien, it's been a really fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produced the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about upcoming programs on Think and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.